From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, will it be harder to vote in Texas in the coming midterm elections? Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor Vicki Goodwin weighs in. And the Texas Gulf Coast is home to the nation's petrochemical industry. Is this an economic boon or something else?
The median incomes are lower in these cities. The poverty rate's higher. The unemployment rate is higher. And none of the normal economic indicators are they keeping up with the state.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Early voting begins October 19th for the November 3rd midterm election. But will you be able to cast your ballot? The state of Texas has 1.2 million voters on the suspension list. And in Republican-controlled Tarrant County, they are closing a third of their polling locations. Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor Vicki Goodwin is speaking out about efforts to make casting a ballot more difficult. We did reach out to Republican incumbent Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick to give him equal time. We have not heard back. Goodwin is critical of the Tarrant County Commissioner's Court, which voted along party lines to close 92 polling locations.
The end result is they closed down a third. At a time when the county has grown substantially, they have somewhere around 80,000 newly registered voters since the last election. And where they're closing down the polling locations is also really important. They're closing the polling location at UT Arlington, the college campus, so making it more difficult for students who are busy with their lives and less likely to travel away from the campus to go and vote. But I do think that the actions that they took have stirred folks in Tarrant County. People are paying attention. They see what the Commissioner's Court is doing, and they see that as an attempt to keep people from voting. And I think that that will just energize voters even more.
Over 100 people turned out to address the county commissioners and ask them not to approve this reduction in voting sites. People were pleading with them, saying this was voter suppression. This was an attempt for the Republican Party in Tarrant County to try to retain power. You were there, right?
Yes, I was there and I testified as well. And I pointed out that this looks like, sounds like, and is voter suppression. And I just suggested that the court not vote for this plan, but to go back to the drawing board and keep the same number of polling locations as in the last midterm election, if not increase.
Simultaneously, 1.2 million registered Texas voters are now on the voter suspension list. They're being asked to go online and check their status. We have until October 5th in order to try to rectify these things. Being on a voter suspension list doesn't mean that you can't vote. It does make it more difficult. What do you see happening here? Do you see this also coming from the same vein of trying to suppress voters during the midterms?
Yes, I do think putting that many Texas voters on a suspense list is an attempt to, again, make it more difficult for people to vote. They can show up and vote, but they may have to vote with a provisional ballot, which is not the same as submitting a regular ballot. So I recommend people Google, am I registered to vote, to find the webpage where you can check your voter registration status.
Are you suspicious that this is also dirty tricks?
Yeah, I think so. I think the Republicans are worried. Trump and all of his followers are worried about holding their positions of power. They're worried about Congress shifting to the Democratic side. They're worried about state level races. This is the first time in 30 years where we have a real opportunity to change the power here in Texas. People are tired of Republican policies that aren't helping them in their everyday lives. So I do believe the Republicans are trying everything they can to make it more difficult or confusing to vote this election cycle. It's not just in Tarrant County, but also in Galveston County. They redrew the lines after the primary election. That creates confusion about who is your representative and who you're voting for. And that means people just may skip that box if they don't know the candidate.
Right. This is an exceptionally competitive general election for the statewide races, and your race is no exception to that, as you run for lieutenant governor facing the current Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. There has been polling with some conflicting results. A late July Texas A&M Bush School Recon MR poll placed you at 48% and Patrick at 46%, statistically tied. Other polls have shown you trailing behind Dan Patrick. So do you think that these types of efforts to limit voting, make voting difficult, try to give people the idea that why bother to vote, that this is a way to try to close a gap when every vote counts?
I do. I think the Republicans are concerned that they may lose elections here. Dan Patrick in that one poll is 2 points behind me, and I think that sent a signal that they need to be concerned. So they're trying to close down polling locations in Tarrant County to lower the vote, particularly in communities where you find more density, oftentimes more apartments, more people who move more off frequently. They don't have transportation, perhaps, to get to the polling locations. And so when you move a polling location further away, you may have fewer voters. It also creates longer lines at election time, and sometimes people just don't have the time to wait in a long line. So they definitely are attempting to lower the vote.
In such a critical race where it is tight, and this is a powerful position for the state of Texas, all the more reason why there should be some opportunity to have a debate between the two candidates. You, Vicki Goodwin, have offered to be part of a public debate with Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. And he has not agreed to a debate. I asked, he requested his office if he wanted to come on to Texas Matters to take some questions, and I have not heard back from him on that, but he has an open invitation at equal time if he so chooses to accept that. So what's happening with this debate?
I think that we should debate. The lieutenant governor is one of the most powerful positions in the state of Texas. Don't voters deserve the opportunity to see the two of us side by side talking about the issues that are important to Texas voters? So I've asked for three debates. I would love to have just one, even, so that voters have that information to make a good, sound decision when they vote in November.
This is a pattern. We're seeing this a lot from Republicans. Governor Greg Abbott's not going to debate against Gina Hinojosa, I don't think. Ken Paxton, Attorney General, is running away from debates against James Tallarico, his challenger for the Senate. I mean, don't Republicans think that the voters deserve to hear what they're all about, not just these highly produced, misleading 30-second campaign ads?
I think the Republican leadership in Texas doesn't feel like they have to debate us. And so I think that they are mistaken. Voters are not going to be happy when they won't stand side by side and let them hear from us directly. What are the differences in our policy ideas?
Well, voters are certainly interested in where these politicians are standing on data centers. They have been champions of data centers, trying to bring them to Texas, giving them tax incentives, sales tax breaks, allowing them to set up shop Texas quickly. And now that we've seen that this is an issue that 75% of voters, regardless of party, are opposed to, we're hearing that now they don't want data centers, or at least that's what they're saying now. Well, what do you think about this flip-flop that we've heard from, or teraflop, if you know your computer terminology, when it comes to data centers and Republicans?
Yeah, I think they're seeing so many people coming out on this issue, going to city council meetings and county commissioner hearings and really saying we want a moratorium. We want to stop these data centers at least long enough to understand how much energy and water they're using and to make sure that they're not pushing the cost for new transmission onto ratepayers in our households. And so the governor recognizes this is a huge issue that people are angry about, and he has said that he wants to pause the data centers and get this information and make sure costs aren't going up because of it. But those are just words. Those are political words said during an election cycle. Unless he calls a special session and puts things into writing and in law, then it's meaningless.
An adjacent issue are the 765 kilovolt transmission lines. We heard from so many rural Texans going to Austin and testifying that they did not want these massive, massive transmission lines. Texas has never seen anything like this before, these transmission lines. They're not just the ones that you know of. These are much bigger, and they will be fragmenting farmland, ranch land, going through natural areas. They said, there's another way we can do this using the current transmission lines and other technology, but still the Texas regulators are accepted this proposal to install these transmission lines over the voices of these rural landowners. So what do you take away from that?
Yeah, I actually met some of the rural landowners that are very angry, actually have filed lawsuits against the transmission lines. And I think it deserves more conversation. I think the hearing that was held at the Capitol with the legislature was fairly one-sided, with the companies saying, we must have this new transmission. I'm not convinced. And so I think it deserves more study to determine, can we provide the energy that's needed without these huge transmission lines taking energy across the state? Why not generate energy where we need it? I think that's possible.
During Ken Paxton's 2023 impeachment, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick presided over the Senate trial that ended with Paxton's acquittal, but he also received a truckload of contributions, political contributions, and a $2 million loan from Defend Texas Liberty, a major pro-Paxton PAC. Do you think there's some sort of connective tissue to Ken Paxton's his alleged corruption and Dan Patrick?
Absolutely. I think this is the definition of corruption. When you have someone who has received millions of dollars connected to someone that they're the head judge in the trial of, you know, Ken Paxton was acquitted with Dan Patrick being the head judge of that trial, and he had received money from associates of Ken Paxton. So to me, that is just absolutely corrupt.
Well, what about the evidence that was presented in that trial about Ken Paxton that showed that his own employees were blowing the whistle on him, saying that he was accepting bribes, that he was abusing his power in his office? It seemed there was enough there for his own party members in the Republican Party in the House to have him impeached. But yet, when they got to the Senate, with Dan Patrick's leadership there, they were not able to close the deal. So do you think money influenced that?
Yeah, I'm in the House and I was there when we read through and saw all of the evidence against Ken Paxton showing his abuse of power. And I asked my Republican colleagues who voted for impeachment why they voted for impeachment. And they said, because it's the right thing to do. It's clear that he is guilty. And so they voted for impeachment, even though there was pressure on them. They had received calls from Ken Paxton saying, you know, don't vote for impeachment. They were threatened. And that happened in the Senate as well. But even more pressure was put on the members to vote for acquittal.
Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick recently declared that the separation of church and state is not in the Constitution. Yes, that precise phrase is not there, but there is the First Amendment that prohibits the government from establishing a religion. Also, we have in the Constitution that we're not supposed to have a religious test for politicians. So we've seen Dan Patrick really lead on these culture issues, leading on trying to put Christian teaching in our public schools. What do you think that about Dan Patrick's belief that there should not be a separation of church and state?
You know, Dan Patrick obviously doesn't understand the meaning of religious liberty. That means that everybody should be free to choose their religion. Instead, what he has done is require the Ten Commandments to be placed on classroom walls. I spoke with someone just yesterday who said his seventh grade daughter, that's pushing her away from Christianity because she doesn't understand why her public school classroom has the Ten Commandments on the wall. I think there is meant to be a separation of church and state. I think that everyone has the ability to choose what religion they follow or no religion. And unfortunately, that's not what Dan Patrick believes.
The reason why Texas is a Republican state, we haven't had a statewide elected Democrat in 30 years, is because Republicans have dominated rural Texas for years. These rural counties will vote 80% Republican or more. But now we're seeing in these rural communities, hospital closures, school funding issues, the vouchers doesn't help them, water supplies issues, the transmission lines, policies that are hurting the economy of rural Texas. So do you think that rural Republican voters are, they're not going to become Democrats, and I don't expect them to, but will they be, are they going through a realignment? Are they deciding we're going to stay home, or we're going to not vote for these people, but vote for some people? And how does that fit with your campaign?
Yeah, every day I hear Republicans saying that they are reevaluating their stance. You know, rural Republicans are reevaluating their party because the Republican Party is not helping them right now. I met with some ranchers the other day who, one rancher in particular, lost 87 head of cattle over the last few years. He had reached out to Governor Abbott to see if he could get some help to pass a bill to help with their particular situation, which deals with chemicals coming from a neighboring property. Unfortunately, he never heard back from Governor Abbott, and that infuriates him. He nearly came to tears saying how difficult it is for ranchers to survive these days. And of course, they're really unhappy with Trump, the tariffs, bringing in beef from other countries. You know, they're really reevaluating the Republican Party at this moment in time. A couple of them that were in that meeting said they weren't sure if they could vote for Democrats, but they certainly weren't going to vote for Republicans this election cycle.
So what is your pitch to these rural conservatives who, they don't like data centers, they don't want transmission lines, they also don't like Democrats? You know, there are issues like guns, abortion, immigration, things like that. So what's your pitch to them? Do you think that you can improve the quality of life, the economic conditions that are in rural Texas, especially when you come to things like Medicaid expansion?
Yeah, absolutely. My pitch to rural Republicans or anyone in the state, to be honest, is that I want to support our public schools, fix our broken healthcare system, address affordability, and plan for our future water and energy needs here in the state of Texas. I want to focus on the things that really have an impact on people's lives and not get distracted by the things that we don't agree on. We're not ever going to agree 100% on every issue. Even within our own parties, we don't always agree entirely. But let's talk about the things that are going to have a big impact on your lives. Healthcare, I have a big plan for healthcare here in Texas. And in talking to some doctors, even they say, what we have right now, anything would be better. So expanding Medicaid would bring billions of dollars back to the state of Texas. Why are we not doing that? Why are we letting other states have our money?
The Republican Party, if they lose Texas, if Texas is no longer the ruby red, reliable Republican state, that's going to be very difficult for the overall national trend for the Republican Party. Don't you think that they're going to do anything and everything they can in order to keep that from happening? I mean, not change policies, but just trying to continue with the shenanigans to try to keep Democrats from voting?
You know, I am worried about that. And so at both the state and national level, we have folks that are reminding anyone who has time during election to be a poll watcher. Go put your eyes on what's happening at our polling locations and make sure that there aren't any shenanigans happening. There's a hotline for anything that seems unusual or against the rules or law that people can call and make sure that things run smoothly and correctly this election cycle.
When you jumped into this race, things in the politics looked a lot different than they do right now. It would still look like it would be an amazing uphill battle to beat Dan Patrick for lieutenant governor. That was before gas prices and diesel prices went sky high and the war is looking uglier every day. And Donald Trump seems to be more erratic every day. Did you think this was what the situation would be by November 3rd, 2026, that things would be so bad that Republican Texans would actually consider voting for a Democrat?
No, I didn't anticipate that things would be so bad that rural Republicans would be looking favorably at Democrats to vote for us. But, you know, and I'm really not happy that things are so bad that that's what it's come to. But I really try to put forward reasonable policy. Everybody cares about their neighborhood public schools. Let's talk about that. All the things that I'm running on, people, regardless of party, should want to have those same goals that I do. And so my hope had been that, hey, let's look at having a reasonable Democrat run the state or be at the top of the state leadership, because we've had 30 years with Republicans running the state. And I don't think that has served Texans well.
That was Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor Vicki Goodwin. We did reach out to Republican incumbent Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick to give him equal time whenever he wants, and we have not heard back. The Texas Gulf Coast is home to the nation's largest collection of petrochemical facilities. They arrived with a promise to build a booming economy, but did they deliver? A new report from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis finds that the petrochemical industry is not bringing the promised jobs, but their host cities are seeing blight, health issues, and devalued property. Trey Cohen is the author of the report, Texas Petrochemical Expansion Lacks Rewards for Host Cities.
There was probably about $40 billion invested in steam cracking or ethane cracking capacity on the Texas Gulf Coast. And Texas being the largest producer of petrochemicals in the nation, you would think that with such a big influx, because we're talking about increasing the size of production by about 60% for this region, you would think that you would see some kind of results in the surrounding community, as far as that's an awful lot of investments. So what happens to communities as far as does it really produce the kind of job growth that has been claimed by the producers themselves in this case? And the answer is you can't find much results that this really makes a difference in the economies of those communities.
So there's an abundance of ethane in Texas because of the Shell Revolution. So they had that on the cheap. There was a race to build a lot of these plants on the Texas Gulf Coast to take advantage of that. They made a lot of promises. They put a lot of investment into building these facilities to do the cracking, yet they're not delivering in the economic. Was it a bait and switch economic promise?
That's a one way to look at it, but I think that there's just been so much conditioning of people's perceptions over the years that, okay, there's these high paying jobs that will come along with a building a new facility. And there are to some degree, but it's extremely capital intensive project, meaning you're spending a lot of money. You're putting a lot of your resources into a fixed cost, that unit. It's not a lot of money that's actually flowing to the jobs, I guess is the best way to look at it. And if you're a producer, petrochemical producer, what you're trying to do is bring your costs down. And you don't do that by hiring a lot of people. You keep it as tight as you can to keep your margins as high as you can. To your question about was it a bait and switch, it's whenever you look at a city and they go, the city officials go, oh, this is going to be good for our economy to build this petrochemical plant there, they're probably looking at it more from a sense of it improves our tax base. We have this huge bump in our tax base from this investment that this company made. And so that makes their bonds look better from a standpoint of you've got a larger borrowing base. And, you know, generating revenue for the city or county or whoever you're looking at, they're looking at it from a standpoint of what's it do for the city. But as far as, and it seems like the easiest thing to point to is the new jobs that it creates. And while it does create some, there's this, you know, they always call it a multiplier effect. It's all these indirect and induced jobs. Yeah, they know that number is inflated, saying like, if I produce one direct job is going to produce seven new jobs. Those six or seven, how do you ever count them? It's an easy thing to promise, but it's hard to actually go back and look at it and figure out, well, how many extra jobs did this one job create? I mean, there's no accountability for how well these projects actually do deliver on those claims.
Well, let's talk about what this does for the tax base. Don't they frequently, the first thing they do is they come and they ask for tax incentives. They want property tax exemptions, and also they don't have to pay a lot of sales tax. So don't they get sales tax exemptions as well?
Yeah, so in this report, we actually just looked at the tax abatement side of it, and you're absolutely correct that in most cases, they are getting some kind of sales tax exemption too. And the reason why I focus on the tax abatement was I could actually see these companies' applications. It's for the whole facility in these applications for tax abatement versus if you actually go out to look at the taxing rolls, everything is like broken up into little different pieces of equipment. So for a, like, just say one plant in LaPorte, it may be listed under like 15 or more different pieces of equipment within it that you're then having to tie back together. Sometimes they're not even named the same company.
But so these things are segmented in order so they can get around some of the requirements of having to pay taxes.
And I think it's it makes it, again, harder to actually understand exactly what's happening because there's so many different little pieces to then add back up. So I was taking a more simple approach of, okay, here is what the company is saying whenever they're making the application to the school district in the state of Texas. Your question about, are they receiving tax incentives and to what degree? In this case, they built out $40 billion in new ethylene capacity, then took from the school districts $1.8 billion back from them. And that's over a 10-year period of taxing going forward. Yeah, it's they're not on part of their school district property taxes, their or ad valorem taxes, they're not paying the full rate. They're paying just a small amount of their taxes that they should be. Again, they'll say, oh, we're going to pay our property taxes based on this high investment that we made. But then as the years go by, they're constantly each year, and it's their legal right to do so, they're challenging what that property value is so that by the time that they get into the part where they're paying taxes back, you know, at the full rate or at what the agreed upon rate is, by the time they get there, the value of the property, they beat it down to where it's, a fraction of what they claim that they would be paying taxes on.
And when we hear people like Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick talking about property tax cuts, really these big refineries are the biggest beneficiaries of that type of legislation.
They are definitely very big beneficiaries of it. Yes, totally agree.
These petrochemical host cities, they were told to expect prosperity, but instead they're getting, as you say in your report, blight, health issues. So what about that?
There's been quite a bit of research. You see more cancer around these cities that are closer to the petrochemical plants. You see their property values are reduced relative to the rest of the state because of their proximity.
They smell bad.
Exactly. And that's the whole point is, like, you look at the population growth of these cities over the last 10 years, and it's a little bit above stagnant versus, you know, the state's grown pretty well on its population. And that's the whole thing is nobody wants to live close there unless they have to. And so it doesn't have this big pull of attraction to it. There's a little appeal for living in these communities, and you can build stuff like this, but it's not going to attract more people other than the construction jobs that are temporary to build it, and then the small number of people that actually are there to run it. It's this multiplier is a fallacy that's out there, and that's what we're trying to show, that if you look at the median incomes are lower in these cities, the poverty rate's higher, the unemployment rate is higher, the growth of their populations is so much slower. In none of the normal economic indicators are they keeping up with the state.
Trey Cohen is an energy analyst at the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. He is the author of the report, Texas Petrochemical Expansion Lacks Rewards for Host Cities. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. Download and subscribe to Texas Matters wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.